Hello and welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Dave Baxter, Deputy Personal Finance Editor. And joining me today are Ed Smith, Head of Asset Allocation Research at Rathbones, and our Personal Finance Editor, Leonora Walters. Now, much of the talk of recent months has centered around Neil Woodford and the decision back in June to suspend dealing on his equity income fund as he tried to deal with a heightened level of investor redemptions. Leonora, it's already been quite a ride, I think it's fair to say, but we're about 3 months on now and we have another set of fresh developments. Can you take me through what's happened now?
Yeah, I think the main thing that's happened, and it's maybe slightly shocking, is LF Woodford Equity Income, the fund which was suspended from trading on the 3rd of June, has stopped publishing its 10 largest holdings every month and won't disclose these again until it resumes trading, which is expected to be in December. And this sets it apart from the vast majority of other funds available to UK private investors, as all of these disclose their top 10 holdings. And it's also quite a departure from Woodford Investments Management's policy in the past. They used to publish not just the top 10 holdings, but the entire list of holdings for all their funds every month. And they stopped doing that, I think it was about 2 months ago, and now they've kind of like taken this step basically to not disclose anything that LF Woodford Equity Income has.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, another thing I was thinking of is, you know, they tried to be very full on with the disclosure. They even, in Equity Income, I remember, used to break out which their holdings were quoted and which were not quoted. And then they sort of took that away and it's gradually been rolled back. So I suppose if you're an investor in this suspended fund, you want to know what's going on. That might seem quite frustrating. But what would you say is the logic behind this this decision?
Well, I suppose I don't know, but the fund's authorised corporate director, that's Link Fund Solutions, says the reason they've done that is Neil Woodford is obviously currently repositioning the fund to achieve two things. He's obviously got to raise a pile of cash to give to those investors who want to take the money out of the fund. And he's also orientating it away from unquoted and illiquid holdings to more mainstream stocks. So as he's doing this and basically selling and buying stuff, they say that if, you know, you have any idea of what's in the fund, other investors, probably institutional investors, might look to buy holdings cheaply, go for a fire sale, or they might bet on the prices falling. That's basically short selling. And there has been evidence of short sellers moving in on some of the holdings in Woodford funds. Now, short selling, for anybody who doesn't know, is basically where, let's say, one party, and it's usually an institution like a hedge fund, right? Not just a regular person. This hedge fund will take a bet on the price of an asset or stock falling rather than investing in it, which is what an investor would normally do. Now, if there's a lot of short selling, it's almost self-fulfilling. It can drive an asset's price further down. So bear in mind that Woodford is trying to sell holdings, raise some cash, and also trying not to do it at a fire sale, you know, get it at a fair price, decent price. You know, obviously he doesn't want a load of short sellers driving down the prices of what he's got, or else he can't raise the cash he needs to meet the redemption. So fair enough, from that perspective, they don't want, you know, these hedge funds basically to swoop in like vultures, short sell and, you know, kind of make the situation even worse.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people bargaining down the prices or shorting his holdings will kind of have a knock-on effect on returns. And how has the fund done recently while it's been suspended in terms of performance?
Not good at all. But hey, you know, what's the difference? It hasn't done well for quite a while. In terms of performance, between the 3rd of June and the 21st of August, LF Woodford Equity Income lost 11.15%. while the FTSE All-Share Index rose 1.52%. So quite a differential there. Mm. And Woodford Investment Management says that there are some particular reasons for this. The main one being difficulties with a shareholding called Burford Capital, whose share price had declined sharply due to, I think, some research put out by a company called Muddy Waters Research, which basically dig the dirt in certain shares. And it also had a write-down on its holding in unquoted cold fusion technology company Industrial Heat.
Yep, yep.
The other funds haven't done brilliantly either. I mean, Woodford Patient Capital Trust, for example, over the 3 months to the 29th of August, fell 17%, while the FTSE All-Share was flat, a.k.a. hasn't fallen or risen. That said, Woodford Patient Capitalist is very different to the FTSE All-Share.
Yes, yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess looking on the brighter side, perhaps, is the equity income funds on track to reopen in, I think Link said early December.
They did say early December. Link says it still is, but, you know, obviously they're not showing holdings. We don't know what's going on. So all we can do is take Link at their word. You know, it's a...
I guess we'll see in the next 28-day updates. Mm. Okay, thanks for that. Do look at this week's funds coverage for more on the latest Woodford news. We also look at what I guess is a related issue, which is how you can spot when a fund might have become too large and the consequences this can have for you as an investor. Now, Neil Woodford might be dealing with some pretty hefty liquidity issues, but he has also been known for having quite an upbeat view in recent years on the UK economy. This is at a time when Brexit uncertainty has led many investors to decide to steer clear of UK equities. But obviously this week we've had some fairly big news on the Brexit front. The Prime Minister plans to suspend Parliament as he looks to move ahead with some form of departure from the EU by his deadline of the end of October. So, Ed, as I alluded to, when it comes to asset allocation, many investors, like politicians, like families, like friends, have been pretty torn on the Brexit front and whether UK equities represent a bargain or a bit of a trap. Does this latest development change the equation?
Well, if you are someone who believes that the government's move is a usurpation of Parliament's sovereignty, and I say if, I'm not judging, don't send me hate mail, and certainly not Dave and Leonora, you may be interested to note that there's a very deep literature linking the quality of a country's democratic institutions and rates of growth, cost of capital, return on investment.
Yeah.
But let's be honest, markets aren't that long-termist. What does it mean in the short term? It means that the risks of no deal have gone up. And whether or not you think no deal is likely to be in the best interests of the country economically in the long run, that's only ever going to be achieved in the very long run. And in the short term, we think at least a mild contraction is likely in the event of a no deal. And over the medium term, businesses' costs of doing business, costs of trading go up. So that could change that equation. Companies that previously looked cheap in light of a no deal may no longer look cheap once you adjust down those rates of growth or those profit margins. That said, it shouldn't change the equations for companies that derive most of their earnings overseas that just happen to be listed on the London Stock Exchange.
So we're talking sort of half of the FTSE 100 or something.
Well, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to see the no deal probabilities. Some people are now looking at something like 35% likelihood. I guess for investors, UK investors, many of them are still, you know, quite fond of UK equities. That might be because of the classic kind of home bias. You know, you like your local markets almost, or because of the fact that there's a decent yield. You know, it's still something like 4.5%, maybe slightly less. If you're still kind of having a decent allocation to UK stocks, what do you now need to be aware of?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you need to be aware of the sectors that are most sensitive to that uncertainty around no deal and the future of the UK economy. So economically, it's it's business investment and construction that's most sensitive to uncertainty. So you might want to think about avoiding stocks that are particularly geared into those areas. And just in terms of how the market tends to react to the economy and doubts about the economy, well, it's general retail, it's construction, it's leisure goods, most financial services other than non-life insurers that are particularly sensitive to the UK business cycle. And it's, you know, your usual, your utilities, your healthcare, your non-life insurers that are less sensitive.
And I guess on a similar note, a lot of the kind of Brexit reaction we've seen so far from investors has been coming through via sterling over the last 3 years. A big way to kind of think about how you're affected by that is via kind of market cap.
Right.
As we mentioned, FTSE 100, you have a lot of companies that will benefit from sterling coming down. How should investors be sort of considering their market cap exposure?
Yeah, well, I mean, the sterling conundrum makes it all the more difficult. As you say, like if we did have a no deal and sterling were to fall, well, usually that should benefit the overseas earners, but then would it actually lead overseas investors just to sell the UK even more than they're doing already? It's difficult to call. I think thinking about market cap, though, regardless of Brexit, we're advocating tilts to large capitalization companies anywhere in the world. And that's because we're undergoing quite a pronounced slowdown in economic activity. And when that occurs, that tends to mean the cyclical higher beta plays underperform those more defensive lower beta plays. And in the market cap spectrum, that usually means large cap outperforms smaller cap. And the earnings underlying the FTSE 100, you know, the UK large cap index, well, they're among the least sensitive to the business cycle of any major bourse anywhere in the world. So we think there's good sort of non-Brexit reasons to favour large cap as well as potentially some Brexit related ones.
Yeah, okay, that's quite interesting. I guess on a related note, let's talk a bit more generally about equities. They've had a really good 2019, sure. Even by, you know, half a year in, many of the kind of mainstream markets have had double-digit returns, which is phenomenal. But obviously, there's a lot to be concerned about as well. You've got the trade war continuing to rumble on. Yeah. You've got another kind of yield curve inversion, which makes investors very nervous. What does this mean for kind of equity investors and... would you say that now makes equities kind of less attractive than they previously were?
Yeah, I mean, this is something we're thinking long and hard about. It's taken up most of my time this year. I mean, the global economy, as I said, is undergoing a slowdown. In fact, it's undergoing its most pronounced slowdown since the financial crisis. Mm. Now, the million-dollar question, it's the trillion-dollar question these days, isn't it, is this another mid-cycle slowdown, or is this the final slowdown that presages the recession? Yeah, is it the beginning of the end, or is it just a mid-cycle blip? Now, our econometric analysis and our qualitative tire kicking at our investment committee meetings cannot yet conclude that this is more than a mid-cycle slowdown. And so we don't think stocks are unattractive. Although I might add the word yet to that to that sentence.
Classic caveat. Okay, then. So let's turn to this week. We've had some reports of UBS Wealth Management, who run a lot of money.
Right.
Apparently have perhaps a slightly different view in that they've moved to recommending their clients go underweight equities. This is the first time they've done so since 2012, when we had the... height of the Eurozone debt crisis. So I guess that represents quite a big change in stance. If someone were to take their advice and kind of pull back on their equity exposures, what do they need to be aware of in terms of the kind of trade-off that they're they're taking.
Yeah, well, I think let's frame it back in the context of that trillion-dollar question.
Mm.
Timing the beginning and end of a mid-cycle slowdown is very difficult, and you risk eroding returns trying to do so. But if UBS have moved underweight because they think this is the beginning of the end, then that's a lot more justifiable. But I would note that the dangers of moving too early could mean that investors miss out on some returns for potentially quite a long period of time. So, for example, the yield curve, which is getting a lot of attention at the moment, that has inverted on average 14 to 15 months before the start of a recession. And that means that it's inverted around about 10 months before the peak in equity markets. That's quite a long period of time. And there's a lot of variation within that average as well. Sometimes it's even longer. So what we try to do is find investment strategies that work across a number of potential scenarios when we don't have very high conviction on one particular scenario. And that's why we have high conviction at the moment on favoring defensiveness and low beta plays rather than cyclical and high beta plays, because they tend to work in that final phase of the business cycle and during those mid-cycle slowdowns.
Mm. It's interesting. Some people say you can almost make the best returns in those fairly late cycle stages. So
potentially, yeah. I mean, you've seen episodes of natural resource stocks, for example, really generate huge returns in those final stages. Obviously, each stage is different, but there's certainly the potential there.
And apart from sort of taking a defensive approach within your equity exposure, from a broader multi-asset perspective, what options do you have available to you, just as, you know, in terms of defensive plays?
Yeah, well, we want to look for earnings streams, you know, whether they're from the equity, fixed income, or, you know, other markets that have low sensitivities or low betas, if you like, to the business cycle. We've discussed that a bit.
Mm.
And I would also encourage asset allocators not to misuse valuation.
Yeah.
So I think, in fact, I recently wrote a piece on our own website that explains why the price to earnings ratio is possibly the most misunderstood metric in all of investing. And it's often used as a justification for not going into certain sort of defensive markets, perhaps, when you really need them. Yeah, the PE ratio, you've got to bear in mind that it doesn't have any implications, or it doesn't contain any information for where markets are heading over the next 12 months.
Mm.
If you buy countries based on having a low PE ratio, sell the ones with a high PE ratio, you'd have lost money pretty much year after year since 2002. It's even worse for sector allocation. You'd have lost money for 40 years. PE ratios are only useful when you're trying to choose a company relative to its peers in its industry sector, then it can be very powerful. But you've got to bear that in mind, you know, as from an asset allocation point of view, don't misuse some of these valuation metrics and use that, and don't use them as a justification for not owning some of these defensive earnings streams.
What sort of metrics would you kind of turn to instead or alongside it?
Well, if you do want to bring in some valuation metrics, price to cash flow and cash flow based metrics do tend to have a better outcome than the PE ratio.
Mm.
But I would dispense with valuation entirely, making sure that you're not paying silly multiples, and just look at return on invested capital, which has a really great track record of delivering superior market performance. Low leverage, solid gross profit margins.
Mm. Okay, in that case, what do you think then of, this is a very valuations-driven idea, but some people are getting concerned about so-called safe haven assets.
Right.
Looking expensive.
Yeah.
So gold has done very well, for example, government bonds.
Yeah.
What do you think of that argument?
I have some sympathy for that. But yeah, we live in a lower growth world where there seems to be a higher demand for savings than there does for investment. And that's going to mean that interest rates are naturally lower. And so don't think that because bond yields are low today and they used to be around about 5 or 6%, that yeah. means they're incredibly overvalued. But even if you sort of try and compute some sort of natural level for a government bond yields, today's actual yields still look, you know, quite pricey, and safe haven assets, as you said, don't look that attractive. Investors may need to make more tactical use of cash. So we did some analysis on sort of constructing portfolios hypothetically in the 50s and 60s. When interest rates were a lot lower than they were throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and more like where they are, not quite today, but you know, in that ballpark. Mm. And in the 50s and 60s, holding cash rather than bonds led to higher Sharpe ratios, higher risk-adjusted returns. And so investors may need to make more tactical use of cash. Now, I know that some investors don't like using cash, especially if they've got to pay a fee on it, or you know, if they're holding it on a platform or with an investment manager. But yeah, we're not saying that you should own this, have a load of cash on your books for the long term. Just make more tactical use of it, and withdrawing cash from your investment portfolio means that you are giving up the option value embedded in being able to redeploy it in a timely manner. Take it out and put it into your, repay your mortgage or something. It's difficult to take that back out and put it back into stocks, right?
So it's that dry powder in case
exactly move.
Okay, thanks for that. That was really interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, pleasure. That brings us to the end of today's show. Do have a look at this week's Investors Chronicle or the websites at www.investorschronicle.co.uk for more on the Woodford suspension and how to see if a fund has taken on too much money. Thanks for listening and have a good weekend.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.